we're not going to abandon you. But the specter of abandonment is more visceral than before. And from all of the reporting my colleagues have done in other areas of Trump policy, we see a more disciplined, systematic administration trying to work here, working out who would staff positions, who would take up jobs, how they would get their stuff done, not the chaotic whirlwind of politics that we saw in the Trump years. And that makes me much, much more concerned.
You didn't pay? You're delinquent? No, I wouldn't protect you. In fact, I would encourage them, Russia, to do whatever the hell they want. You gotta pay. Now in February, former and possibly future US President Donald Trump launched a spine-chilling injunction to America's allies in the sheer style of a New York City mob boss. If you'd like to enjoy the blessings of NATO membership, pay up or face the consequences. Now, Trump's comments constitute a significant break with settled policy precedent. America has provided a powerful security umbrella to most of Europe since at least 1948, but this time, it could well be under threat from America First 2.0. Now, this week, we care to explore if Europe would be able to hold on its own two feet without American backing. Just how strong are Europeans without the Americans? And has the old continent upped its military-industrial capacity since the war in Ukraine? We are joined by Shashank Joshi, defense editor of The Economist, and Bruno Tertre, deputy director at La Fondation pour la Recherche Stratégique, and recently the author of Pax Atomica. As always, please rate and review on Common Decency on whatever platform you use, and send us your comments or questions either on Twitter at UndecencyPod or by email at UndecencyPod@gmail.com. And please consider supporting the show through Patreon at www.patreon.com/UndecencyPod to get access to the full episode where we talk in further detail about nuclear policy. And here's something special for you this week. Do you love the intersection of strategy and diplomacy? Do you think you could have secured a better Brexit deal for the United Kingdom? Well, How to Win Brexit is the brilliant board game that allows you to relitigate the wars over Britain's departure from the European Union and roleplay as the French president or the British prime minister. Whether you're a political enthusiast, a board game fanatic, or both, this game should be up your alley. Great news for our patrons. We will be distributing two sets over the next 2 weeks. So if you're on the fence, you might want to join us now. Enjoy the episode.
So, we often use the expression American security umbrella. What does it mean in practice, though? How reliant is Europe, and I mean Europe beyond just Ukraine, how is it reliant on the US for its security in practice, starting maybe with you, Shashank?
Well, how do we count the ways? I'd say there's sort of three big buckets of stuff we should think about. One of them is conventional security, that is conventional collective defense, in the form of America's military commitment to the defense of Europe, principally through Europe. But of course, that also has a bilateral dimension. America has some separate bilateral military ties to key European countries separately from NATO as well. The second bucket is nuclear deterrence and the contribution of America's strategic nuclear forces and its non-strategic nuclear weapons to European defense, and the resulting nuclear umbrella, if you like that term. And I think the third category of things we should think about is a little bit more intangible, but the sense of contribution to American diplomatic and security leadership in Europe. And I have in mind things like the fact that it's America that has tended to chair the Ukraine Defense Contact Group meetings, the so-called Ramstein Group meetings, almost monthly since the conflict began, and other kinds of political leadership that America provides. So I'll pause there, but I think those are the three big categories I would spell out.
Bruno?
I don't disagree at all with the way Shashank characterized this, but perhaps we should take a step back and given the debates in the U.S. Presidential campaign, we should perhaps remind ourselves, why is America providing a security umbrella to Europe? The discussion since 1945 has revolved around two different issues, the question of values and the question of interests. And I believe that it's actually a good thing that we refocusing on interests. Sometimes some American and European officials and experts see the U.S. security umbrella as some kind of a favor to Europe. Well, obviously, as most U.S. presidents have known it since 1949, it's much more than that. It's the U.S. is doing that because it's its own interest to do so. One of the key reasons why the U.S. Senate agreed to ratify the Washington Treaty in 49 is that some were saying, well, you know, that may actually commit us to a war in Europe. And others were saying rightly, well, if we're to do this, to sign this treaty, and then later on create a military organization, it was to make sure that the Europeans do not drag the United States into a new war in Europe without agreeing to. So that's an important part of the security umbrella contract. And there's another one, of course, which always needs to be reminded, is that this has benefited immensely to the United States in several ways. First of all, through the contracts of equipment, defense equipment contracts from European countries to the United States, and also because the presence of U.S. troops in Europe has always been much more than just for defending Europe against Russia or any other European country. It's also a platform for U.S. operations in the Middle East and elsewhere. So I think when we talk about the security umbrella, it's not something that it's just a favor done to the Europeans, as a certain U.S. presidential candidate seems to think it.
Well, speaking and I would that, just add, I would just add a couple of concrete examples to Bruno's point, which is if you look at, for example, the U.S. presence in Germany, the Ramstein Airbase, it was for the last 25 years, it was a major hub for drone strikes in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen. The Landstuhl Military Hospital, I think, treated almost 100,000 American soldiers who were wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the last thing to say is on that subject, of course, this goes without saying in some respects, but the sole occasion on which the Article 5 Mutual Defense Clause of NATO has been invoked was on September 2001, in which European allies came to the aid of America in various different ways after the 9/11 attacks. So I think it's worth just fleshing out Bruno's point.
And on Bruno's finishing points about the a certain political candidate who has a different point of view about the importance of the security umbrella, I think two questions I have. How destructive was Trump's presidency to the security umbrella in practice? Because we all remember some very angry late night tweets which made for a lot of headlines, but practically, how much has the conversation changed in Europe at that time? And secondly, how destructive would a second term be to the security umbrella? Is this a case of we'll see more of Trump, as in, you know, a lot of angry tweets, but maybe less substantive change? Or do we think there's going to be a more aggressive anti-NATO focus, especially from Trump this time, maybe starting with Bruno?
It's a good question. Two points. One, I think it was important for Germany to realize at that point that they could perhaps they should no longer rely only on the United States to provide for their survival. And that's the point that actually Chancellor Merkel made explicitly at least twice publicly. She did say Germany should not rely only on the United States for its defense. So it was kind of a warning that was well heard in Germany. On the side of Poland and the Baltic states, to simplify things a little bit, there was often this idea that as long as U.S. troops are there, we don't care too much about what Trump says. And Secretary of Defense Mattis used to say, don't listen to what he says, see what I do. What he meant by that is that even though Mr. Trump made all his provocative sometimes aggressive statements about the Allies not paying their, quote, fair share, unquote, the Pentagon was quietly reinforcing its permanent presence in Europe. And that was enough for many in Poland and the Baltic states. And the conversation I was having, and I'm sure that Shashank had the same kind of conversation with them at the time, was, well, yeah, okay. But, you know, it takes a tweet to break the contract. So troops are there, of course. But if Mr. Trump wakes up and say, I'm not using those troops, then you won't use them. So that's a long way to prepare you for the answer to your second question, which is about Trump, too. And I'm sure that Shashank and I will have probably the same ideas. That is, well, you know, Trump, too, is not going to be Trump, too. It's going to be Trump squared or Trump's unhinged or Trump's unleashed. I mean, I think most serious analysts agree that we can't simply expect Trump 2 to be the same as Trump 1. At that time, something would probably break. It's unlikely that the main scenario, which is, you know, well, that the scenario that is sometimes talked about Washington, that is, you know, he would withdraw formally from the treaty, but can he really do that legally? Well, there's a whole conversation about that, to which I often say it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. The legal dimension is truly secondary. Again, it would take just a couple of declarations, such as the ones he made during the campaign, just only 2 or 3 weeks ago, and something would be broken. So this time, I think most allies realize that they have to hope for the best, but prepare for the worst.
Shashank?
I agree with all of that. I was certainly struck not just by President Trump's campaign comments that he made a month ago, in which he suggested that so-called delinquent allies, which in his view means allies who were not paying into some mythical fund by which he believes NATO operates, would be subject to attack, and he would encourage Russia to attack them. But I was actually more interested in some ways by an essay written by one of his advisors, Keith Kellogg, who was, I think, a former national security advisor to Mike Pence in the Trump administration, and was briefly acting NSA when Mike Flynn resigned in the Trump era. And Kellogg's proposal was for a so-called multi-tiered alliance in which presumably those who were not meeting the alliance's target of spending 2% on defense would somehow not be subject to the same guarantees of American protection or American intervention. And the reason it's interesting is not because these will necessarily make it into policy. It's because they are slowly but surely eroding the degree to which Article 5 is sacrosanct, that collective trust, that collective faith in Article 5. And whilst you can go back 30, 40 years and find American officials criticizing Europeans, lambasting them in very harsh terms for their insufficient defense spending, Bob Gates comes to mind, I think, most prominently. None of them really touched the inner sanctum, the idea that even if you are, quote unquote, delinquent or whatever less charged term we wish to use, we're not going to abandon you. But the specter of abandonment is more visceral than before. And from all of the reporting my colleagues have done in other areas of Trump policy, we see a more disciplined, systematic administration trying to work here, working out who would staff positions, who would take up jobs, how they would get their stuff done, not the chaotic whirlwind of politics that we saw in the Trump years. And that makes me much, much more concerned.
Thank you. I just perhaps a couple of questions that I like to follow up with, and the second one will be about Ukraine, but specifically when it comes to the debate on defense and security in Europe, it does seem like we're now seeing a sort of a new debate come up, which is not necessarily about defense policy and defense spending, but also about the building of a defense base of shells and tanks and equipment being built in the European continent. In your conversations with defense officials on both sides of the Atlantic, actually, is the bilateral relationship US-EU on defense issues, Europe generally, is the issue of procurement still a concern that actually Europe needs to find companies to actually build these forms of equipment to make sure that this is not just being outsourced and externalized. And I feel like historically in the American public debate, there is a consciousness that there is a defense military complex, I think is the term domestically. Is it, are we evolving towards that sort of understanding in Europe?
Maybe starting with Bruno.
Yeah, that's, as I said, and you want to insert that comment in the final video. That's really not something I have any, you know, competence on. So, I mean, I think it's best that Shashank does it, you know, answers the question. I honestly don't have any points on that.
What I'd say on the question of a European defense industrial base is that, first of all, there's been a much more concerted push in recent years, particularly by the European Union, to try to consolidate a defense industrial base. And we see this in speeches, comments, initiatives, particularly by Thierry Breton, the EU commissioner whose responsibility it is for defense. We see it in the proposal by some European actors for a very substantial 100 billion euro defense fund, in some ways that would mimic or resemble the EU pandemic fund, in which involved joint collateralization of debt, which is a very contentious subject among countries, particularly countries who wish to avoid collateralizing debt and who see this as a matter of a national prerogative. So that's one sensitive point. The other point is also that Europe's defense industry, like defense industries on any continent involving multiple countries, are still, you know, involve national champions, very sensitive companies. And there are always natural debates over in questions of big projects, over how work should be allocated, which countries' companies should be allocated the majority share of these things. And this is a very natural process. And I think that as long as you have national member states, sovereign states, with their own sovereign defense industries, this is going to be a challenge. The final point I will say is that historically, when we discussed this subject, a major point of contention was the American neuralgia over the idea that this process towards a European defense industry, a more common European defense industry, would come at the expense of American firms. This was historically something they always lobbied very hard on, despite the alliance, despite shared security concerns. These commercial worries, financial and industrial worries, were always an undercurrent in transatlantic debates. I don't think they've gone away. I still think you see concern in the administration about movement in Europe towards an industry that might involve less freedom of maneuver for American companies. I don't think it is as sharp a debate as it has been in the past, which is quite interesting. I think there's a realization that actually a more potent, a more capable European defense industry is still in America's interest. Although these industrial jealousies, these tensions are never going to go away completely. And indeed, we still see different models. We see in Poland, a country that's willing to buy huge amounts of foreign military kit from South Korea, from the United States in the form of HIMARS, Apaches, lots of other equipment. And we have concerns in other countries, including France, but others as well, that actually these kind of rapid, huge purchases of foreign equipment to fill short-term gaps undermines the creation of a sustainable defense industrial base. And I don't think even the war in Ukraine has settled those debates.
So, Bruno, I've got a slightly different question here, because I mean, the gist, obviously, for this conversation has been over the last 2 years, what's going on in Ukraine. There's been a transformation of the Russian army over the last 2 years to much larger. I mean, the Estonian annual intelligence report was talking about a Soviet-style mass army, which would kind of develop over the next 10 years. And on top of that, I think the Danish defense minister was arguing a few weeks ago that we couldn't rule out that within the next 3 to 5 years, Russia would be able to test Article 5 and the solidarity of NATO. Now, I'm not going to ask you to predict whether we will see further Russian expansionism, but is this a scenario which is being taken seriously across European capitals?
Well, 2 or 3 points here. First of all, I profoundly dislike the expression, we cannot rule out that. I think when you say that, you say absolutely nothing. The question is about relative probabilities. So I think the message you are getting from several European capitals on the central and eastern side of the continent is the following. If we let Russia win, or at least not lose, in Ukraine, then the probability that at some point a military attack against a NATO member is a probability that rises significantly, to the point maybe that in case of a significant victory, in Ukraine by Russia, we could face the return of a massive potential military threat by Russia against Europe. So I think that that's the message that they're trying to get across. Now, it's difficult to see how much of a threat in terms of mass the Russian armed forces could be in 3 years from now. First of all, I don't think that Russia had completely abandoned mass, even though they were transitioning from quantity to quality, but they never completely abandoned mass. Now, going back to the precise question you raised, I think the possibility of a test against, of a military test against a territory or forces covered by Article 5 is indeed a serious scenario, much more than the idea of returning to a quasi-existential military threat coming from the east. But that is something that in the current context, Europeans have to think about because of, once again, because of the Trump scenario. Mm. So you have these two, you have actually three strands of thought that lead us Europeans to think differently about defending ourselves in the coming 5 to 10 years. There's the war in Ukraine and its immediate and long-term consequences, depending on the outcomes. There is the possibility that Mr. Trump becomes president in 2025. And then finally, looming on the horizon, there's, of course, the China question and the consequences for Europe of a sudden war in East Asia that would lead the United States to not only be largely preoccupied by Asia more than Europe. And you have this debate in Washington about, you know, Asia first or Europe first, just exactly as you had in the 50s, and the concrete consequences that could that it could mean for Europe in terms of reallocation of forces, even though, of course, the army, the U.S. Army, would be much less involved in an Asian contingency than in Europe. But in terms of transport and a range of defense equipment that are present in Europe, certainly some of them would be reallocated to Asia. So overall, you have these three three major factors, three major causes that do lead us to, you know, to this quasi-consensus in Europe that because of these three factors, we do have to do even more than what we are doing right now. I personally think that going to 4% of defense budget is something that will not happen. Maybe it should happen, but it won't. But seriously, but in general, that's something which is increasingly becoming more consensual, because the more we spend nationally, the more we'll be ready for whatever the scenario is, taking into account these three factors that I mentioned: Ukraine, Trump, and China.
Shashank, you had some thoughts on this.
I agree with all of that. Just to say that from all the conversations I've had in the last year, but also just the last month alone, there are significant disagreement within NATO amongst allies over how long it will take for Russia to reconstitute its force in quality, not just build raw numbers, but if they haven't got the guns or training or troops, but to rebuild a meaningful force. We're talking about a huge margin of error here, a huge error bars. The figure that was cited to me by Rob Bauer, who is chairman of the International Military Committee for NATO, was about 3 to 7 years. But he acknowledged this depends on the degree to which Western sanctions are tightened, the degree to which they remain in place following the end of a conflict. It depends on the course of the war in Ukraine. It depends on how much attrition Russia suffers in the months ahead, on all of these things. And 3 to 7 years is a pretty wide time frame. But to state the obvious, the concern here is that Russian rearmament may be proceeding on a quicker timeline than European rearmament, and that will put Russia in a stronger position to believe it can mount a military challenge of some kind, even if not a full-fledged invasion of a NATO member state against the West. And we must always remember here, with the lessons of February 22 in our head, to avoid mirror imaging, to avoid imagining that the conditions we think are the right ones to conduct a military challenge to test NATO resolve are the same ones that the Russian leadership perceives. They can misapprehend their own strength. They can misapprehend NATO's preparedness. And I think that's one reason why we saw the UK Chief of Defence Staff just last week try to clamp down very publicly, very aggressively on all the sort of war talk. He was saying, look, guys, calm down, get a grip. We're strong. Russia would lose quickly if it attacked us. You know, he was trying to say, whatever you think about reconstitution, right now there's no risk of an attack. And by talking about it this much, by panicking in this way, you may actually be projecting weakness and undermining deterrence. And it's a really interesting dynamic at the moment playing out.
Shashank, maybe just a few words on how do we evaluate Europe's battle readiness? I mean, one metric would be GDP, how much money we're spending, and I think roughly even with what Russia is spending altogether. But obviously, that doesn't translate into the same thing. How do we kind of evaluate how ready we are in Europe for a kind of conflict on our borders again?
Well, money is nice. Money helps. And if you add it up, we do spend more collectively than Russia, even if you measure Russian defense spending in terms of purchasing power parity, which some think is a more appropriate way to measure its spending. Even then, collective European spending outstrips Russia. There are some areas of European strengths. We have decent infantry forces. We have decent naval forces. We have decent air forces. To cut a long story short, the biggest concern is in our ability to have high readiness, combat capable forces that can do the job they need to do because of all the enablers and supporting capabilities they need. And in that respect, I would point to the importance of things like logistics, air defense, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance platforms, command and control capabilities, including the very high-level headquarters needed to command large-scale military operations. All of these kinds of capabilities that tend not to figure as highly in the public debate. Yes, there are other issues as well. If you look at the number of combat battalions in Europe, some of the work done by the International Institute for Strategic Studies shows that actually in the last 10 years, despite the additional spending, the number of new combat capable units has not risen very fast. It's been almost static. And indeed, I've heard American generals in NATO closely following the debate complain that there is still across Europe a real lack of problem with high readiness brigades with sufficient ammunition, training and capability to engage in a high intensity fight. But if I was picking out one thing, it would be all of the enablers that for which Europe right now is still dependent upon the United States.
Okay.
And to pick one example, just focusing on perhaps the one EU member state that is most, I think, crystallized the dilemmas around beefing up and muscling defense spending in the EU. Can you walk us through some of the public opinion in Germany and what is going on with the coalition and government currently in Berlin? And maybe just as, again, crystallizing the larger European debate, do you think that the traditional opposition, the pacifist or the anti-militarist opposition that I think has existed at a higher and a stronger sense in Europe than in other countries, do you think that's abating in a country like Germany?
Starting with Bruno, maybe.
Well, again, this is an issue, I'm afraid. I don't have a lot of added value. Okay, I suppose you'll be cutting that out.
Yeah, don't worry.
I think Germany has a more complex and nuanced approach to defense than just the pacifist caricature that is sometimes made. I think what's extremely destabilizing for Germany is that it has realized that the fundamental basis of its security since 1949 is eroding, and that's something that was never really ready for. The French, intellectually speaking, are more ready to consider the notion of a Europe that needs to defend itself without the United States than Germany ever was. That's point one. Point two, there are two factors at play here, the coalition aspect and the chancellor's aspect, in a sense. I think Mr. Scholz, as we have seen over the past few weeks, is someone that has a very particular conscience of the past and the way Germany was involved or started directly in several major wars on the continent over the past 150 years. And for this reason, he's extremely cautious to walk sort of a fine line between accepting the idea of rearmament. After all, you know, he was the one that launched the Zeitenwende. and not getting involved in something that would give Germany a prominent role that it does not want to have in the management of security in Europe, starting with Ukraine, of course. So I think there's a complexity and a nuance to the German debate sometimes we do not appreciate fully, because, you know, the public statements and public decisions of Chancellor aren't just the part of the iceberg that we see, but it's much more complex inside. And I suppose we're going to talk about nuclear issues later on. And I think that on the nuclear front, that debate has evolved in a fairly mature way, I find. But clearly, Germany is not ready to think about, it's not yet ready to think about a scenario where we have collectively to defend ourselves without the United States.
Shashank?
I just add to that if you look at the German debate, it's an interesting question as to whether the period since 2022 has been revolutionary or incremental. I lean more towards the revolutionary perspective, but it's still constrained by the reality of politics. And so the special fund for defense has pushed Germany above 2%. It's been, you know, a huge influx of money to the point where it's not actually clear whether the Bundeswehr can absorb all this extra money in a single year. It's actually quite difficult to suddenly spend huge quantities of money in defense. It isn't always as easy as you would think. When the special fund runs out in 2028, so we have a little while to go, the German government of that time will have to find roughly about an extra 25 to 35 billion euros a year extra to keep defense spending at that elevated level. And by the way, it will be such an elevated level that they will be spending more in aggregate than France and the UK, which is quite a kind of historically interesting moment for Europe, I think. But the problem, as those who follow German politics will understand, is that German budgets are constrained. Spending is capped by a constitutional debt break, which means that it limits how much you can borrow. So if you spend more on defense, you either have to overcome that debt break, remove it constitutionally, or you have to spend less on other things. And even for a German public that recognizes the threat from Russia, that sees the historic stakes in Ukraine and the importance of Germany playing its role, you know, this is a difficult conversation to have. But at the end of the day, even if 3 or 4 years ago, Bruno, I don't know what you think, but if I'd been asked, will Germany deploy a full strength brigade in Lithuania, becoming the only country in NATO to deploy a full strength brigade on an Eastern Front state amongst all the countries that run the enhanced forward presence battle groups, I would have said you're crazy. That's ridiculous. Mm. And here we are, it's a reality, and we're only debating the timeline on which Germany will deploy that brigade. So I think we have to recognize, you know, not take for granted the scale of the change that's occurred in the last 2 years.
I think Germany feels the pressure. It's not comfortable with the pressure. The pressure comes from its allies, including the United States. The pressure comes from Poland, which is actually quite happy to give lessons, to its Western partner. And I don't think that someone like Mr. Scholz reacts well under pressure. That being said, indeed, we should not look only at the glass being half empty, but also at the glass being half full. And Shashank reminds us that indeed, the full-fledged brigade, you know, is kind of a big deal for Germany, as it would be for any other NATO countries.
I just want to cross the Rhine, so to speak, and go to France. On the 25th of February, there was this big summit in Paris with heads of state and government from all over Europe about the aid to Ukraine. And Emmanuel Macron made a comment when asked by, I think it was Anja Nussbaum of Bloomberg. He was asked a question about the possibility of having troops in Ukraine. Now, it's a very complicated quote, so I want to make sure I don't get it completely off. But the idea is, the scenario of sending troops to Ukraine has been mentioned. Everything is on the table, has not been ruled out. Essentially, he doesn't commit to a policy, but it says essentially it could exist. The idea is to develop some strategic ambiguity. Bruno, is that roughly right? How would you describe essentially what Macron was doing here? Is this a change, a break in the European doctrine? Is there a reason for why he's pushing that, or actually is there a lot more continuity with what has been done previously?
Well, clearly it was a significant statement, but let me make 3 points here. First of all, the quote is actually much more complex than the way you just framed it. He says, you know, if we are to do what we already plan to do, you know, in terms of military assistance to Ukraine, then there will come a point where we will probably need to have some military troops in Ukraine to actually help service the weapons, to help for training, etc. He never talked about combat troops. Absolutely never. People hear ground troops and they think, oh, combat troops. Absolutely not. But this in itself was something significant. It did not come out of the blue. That's my second point. It was discussed during the meeting. I've had that from several participants. So he did not take all of his counterparts by surprise publicly. And three, there's a particular reason which made Macron eager to show Russia that we were not afraid to think of some kind of incremental progress in our support to Ukraine. It's a complex story which involves, shall we say, the shadow war that exists already on the ground. It involves spies. It involves maybe some special forces from some NATO countries. But there was a particular reason why Macron had decided to escalate the pressure and to show a little bit of muscle after that meeting in Paris on the 29th.
So let me give there's a few quotes within that interview, but essentially he says, there is no consensus at this stage to send troops on the ground. Nothing should be excluded. We will do everything that we must so that Russia does not win. Shashank, any thoughts on this quote and what it might represent for the European defence landscape? And also maybe Macron has been accused quite a lot in France generally at the start of the conflict of being a kind of one of the doves and having been naive on Russia. We did a full episode on this topic actually with Sylvie Kaufmann and Guy Chazan a few weeks ago. Is there also on France's side an opportunity to reposition itself a little bit on being a bit of a more hawkish side? I will comment that the idea that the possibility of sending troops on the ground being mentioned at the summit was rejected by, I think, most other heads of state and government. But nonetheless, this is also creating some interest, from my understanding, in Central and Eastern Europe at this kind of change in the way France is depicting its position in this conflict. Any thoughts on all of that?
I think there's an irony that from in the summer of 2022, I think it was at the NATO summit at the time, if I'm not mistaken, Macron, there was a debate over whether to send tanks and jets to Ukraine. And actually, there was no consensus at the time. All NATO governments were very worried about this. Eastern European ones had already been sending old Soviet-type tanks and indeed some disassembled MiGs to Ukraine. But certainly at the time, Boris Johnson said there are some logistical challenges with this. And Macron, or at least the French government at the time, said, what's important is we don't become co-belligerents. And one of the things they spelt out, I think via background briefings rather than explicitly, was that this included tanks and jets. And that really irritated a lot of Eastern Europeans, not least because they were sending tanks and jets at the time. And there was a sense that this was closing off options. This was an effort to speak for the alliance as a whole. Now, fast forward, and we're in exactly the reverse situation. I think there is understandable frustration that Scholz, in offering such a sharp public rebuke to these comments, has not helped by shutting down options, by limiting ambiguity, and actually by trying to speak for other allies, some of whom may wish to send troops to Ukraine in a non-combat capacity to try to keep the Kremlin on the back foot. Macron himself, of course, has been on a very long-running intellectual evolution over the last 2 years. And I don't think this is a sudden process, right? Even before this, you can go back a year and see his views steadily hardening over time. In just before Munich at the Weimar meeting, We saw him refer, I think, in extraordinarily harsh terms to the Russian government as the Russian regime. Very, very sharp language. This in the summit was the first time he'd used the word defeat in such unambiguous, clear terms. But I think, you know, even if you go back to the decision to send scalp cruise missiles, that to me was emblematic of a French policy that was willing to take much greater risks, that was willing to take a much sharper position in the defense of Ukraine. So I think that we've seen a very steady evolution that goes well beyond any one moment. It's been a long-running thing. On the question of troops, I'll just say one thing. I think the Western countries made a mistake in evacuating Ukraine as quickly and as hastily as they did in February 2022. I realize it is easy for me to say that with hindsight, and that leaders were making very difficult decisions trying to balance up risks. They didn't want to cause rapid and sudden escalation in the event that Russia would overrun the country, as some of them feared. But I think that it would have been far easier had we preserved ambiguity from the beginning, keeping troops in the country, for example, in the West for training purposes, flagging them to Russia, just as in the way that we do in Syria, for instance, with special forces, and we managed to deconflict. Rather than pulling back, starting at zero, and steadily working our way up the escalation chain, trying to preserve ambiguity. It is much easier to put the onus of escalation onto the adversary than putting the onus of making a escalatory decision onto yourself. I think that's one lesson we have identified from the past 18 months.
And obviously the other topic we need to mention is, Bruno, you just published Pax Atomica on the issue of nuclear dissuasion. There is always concern about Russia, about nuclear policy. There's been recently, I think, Russian tactical nukes having moved to Belarus. But at the same time, there's also a history of Russian nuclear policy being quite stable, quite reliable, and apparently a desire by Putin to be seen as a responsible actor on that space. Are we walking on a nuclear tightrope here, or is this mostly a red herring, starting with Bruno?
I see no evidence that we're walking on a nuclear tightrope, to use your expression. Let me add to what you just said, that I don't know of any public evidence that there are Russian nuclear warheads in Belarus. Clearly, the political theater of Putin and Lukashenko wants us to believe that not only are Belarusian troops trained for carrying nuclear weapons with their air forces and some parts of their missiles, but I've seen no evidence that the warheads were there. I think this is mostly to signal that, you know, Belarus is now completely in the hands of the Russian defense system. There is no longer a independent Belarus defense, which makes you wonder why, by the way, incidentally, some Belarusian troops seem to be moving back to Belarus. But that's another question. On the nuclear front, there's another piece of information which I find quite interesting, is the way China has been indirectly and directly, but very publicly, saying that they continue to oppose very firmly any escalation of the nuclear rhetoric. And that's a very important message, because we don't know if Putin listens to us, but it's highly likely that he listens to Xi. So for all these reasons, but also including the fact that the rhetoric used by Putin a few days ago is not that different from the one he's been using in the past, and that's mostly what I call a deterrence reminder. After all, you know, you can't say that it's nuclear saber rattling when a nuclear armed country just reminds you that it has nuclear weapons and that you can't, there are certain lines you cannot cross. I mean, if a French president was doing that, would we call that French nuclear saber rattling? I'm not sure. So that's a long way to say no, I don't think we're on a nuclear tightrope.
Shashank, can you force on that?
The moment of greatest danger was probably late 2022, when there were concerns over the integrity of Russian lines and Russian groupings of forces in Ukraine, particularly, first of all, in Kharkiv province. And there were questions over how far Ukraine might go in its offensive, how far the Russian lines might collapse. whether particularly Russia might lose territory that it had gained prior to 2022. And then later in Kherson province, where there were very sizable numbers of forces remaining on the west bank of the Dnipro in Kherson province, and there were concerns that they could be trapped by a Ukrainian offensive had it been more aggressive. And indeed, there were some in Western countries urging Ukraine to more aggressively go after these. But there were also some who were deeply concerned about the consequences should that should huge numbers of Russian forces be taken prisoner or collapse along with their equipment. And if we think about the nuclear risk, the question has always been, what is Russia trying to deter? What is Russia trying to prevent with its nuclear forces and with some of these reminders, as Bruno says, of its nuclear possessions? And I think there's a kind of very straightforward answer, which is that it wants to prevent direct Western involvement in Ukraine as a belligerent to turn the tide of the war against Russia. And Russia has been successful in that. We have respected that line. There's been a kind of a mutual understanding that that's a reasonable line. But there have also been some ambiguities around the provision of particularly high-end types of equipment. And in particular, the question of a collapse of Russia's position in 2022, I think, was the moment at which Russian threats of limited nuclear use, to the extent that they were plausible, would have been most plausible. The situation is completely different now. Russia's military position is far stronger. It has quite robust defensive lines. There's no risk of a Russian collapse. If anything, the risk of severe changes in the lines are much bigger on the Ukrainian side. This is wonderful for China, by the way, which does not have to blow up its relationship with Europe by rushing major arms deliveries to Russia in the way that it might have had to do at the end of 2022 or the beginning of 2023. And so in some ways, to me, despite the kind of rhetoric, I think the nuclear risks are the lowest they have been in quite a long time. And indeed, when we think about the questions of what we can get away with as Western countries, whether that's the delivery of things like the Taurus cruise missile, or whether that's the question of how far we can aid Ukraine in country, Russia's military strength should be something that gives us room for maneuver diplomatically and politically, rather than panicking at every Russian reminder of its nuclear status.
Bruno, I know you have to wrap up, but if you have any thoughts on this?
There's one question we have not discussed, but which may be the opportunity for another podcast at some point, is the old question, can Europe defend itself without the United States, which is a question that probably deserves a separate discussion. I think that's something which is beginning to be thought about, that you know, many think tanks have done these war games, which I sometimes a bit artificially suppose that you just take out the US elements of NATO and see what the Europeans can do on their own, which may not be the most realistic way to think about this. There's also the nuclear element, of course, which is now being discussed openly and sometimes publicly in a fairly mature way, once again, with key European capitals. Don't listen too much to the debates in the German press or German Bundestag. I think the government, European governments, Poland, France, Germany, are starting to talk about these issues in a fairly, you know, reasonable and mature way, which leads me to just one very quick comment, which is, I think the time-old question, could Europe defend itself without the United States, needs to be approached after we ask ourselves the question, could Europe deter Russia without the United States? I think it's an absolutely fundamental question, and one which is so simple that we forget to ask it. It's a question that I don't have any quick answer to. It's a very complex question. It has to be. It has to involve discussion about, you know, what kind of Europe. That would not be the EU, because the UK would be a key participant here. But I'm opening a big can of worms, so to say, at the end of our conversation, just as a teaser for perhaps our next conversation.
Well, thanks a lot, Bruno, for doing my job of concluding the episode. But I think also, if you want to listen more on the topic of nuclear dissuasion, Bruno had very kindly come to the podcast actually at the end of 2022 with Olga Olika, episode 66, called Going Nuclear, a very interesting conversation on nuclear dissuasion. But thanks a lot to Shashank, thanks a lot to Bruno, this wonderful conversation. We went from Kiev to Paris, going through Berlin, and I think we understand a bit better how the conversation has changed since war in Ukraine, and how the American election could really change that conversation even further. Thanks a lot, and to all of you, see you in the outro.
Okay, so this has been one of the wonkier episodes we've done in the recent past. Francois, do you feel like we're adding value to our audience and that we've somehow helped bridge some of the informational asymmetries? We've helped folks understand defense policy a little bit better and what's going through the minds of decision makers in defense ministries in Europe. Was that objective achieved?
I hope so. I mean, we were very lucky to have two quality guests with Bruno Dertré and Shashank Joshi. Bruno published Pax Atomica, which is really interesting on nuclear dissuasion. I think there's been a rebirth of nuclear policy and dissuasion and so on in the recent past, so that's been really interesting to read. And I think the proximate cause for this episode was an article that Shashank published in The Economist late February, where he does this kind of horizon of the conversation in Europe and interviewing people from all across Europe, including our uncommon decency friend Benjamin Haddad, about the way European defense has adjusted to this landscape. The reason as well it has to adjust at perhaps even faster than it has had to since the war in Ukraine is obviously what's going on in America, and especially in Washington. There's been, over the last 6 months or so, Congress has been held essentially hostage by the political turmoils of the Republicans, who have been increasingly reluctant about giving aid to Ukraine. And at the moment, this is just paralysis, but the scenario we try to explore at the start is, what would more than paralysis mean? What would a Trump presidency 2.0 mean? And what Bruno said is, I don't think we should expect President Trump 2, but President Trump squared, in the sense that the energy, the kind of let's flip the table energy that Trump always had, will go from being an aggressive tweet in the early morning to maybe a more focused policy drive, because he's working to staff an administration rather than simply being going from one issue to another without much focus or drive or follow through. So that's the reason we wanted to do that. I'm always a little skeptical on the idea that Europe is building towards a proper war industry. Undeniably, we've been rocking up our spending. We've been increasing our procurements. All our defense industries have been getting a lot more contracts and so on. But we're still very short of being able to withstand the intensity of the conflict we're seeing in Ukraine, for example. I mean, I don't have exact numbers, but my understanding is that the total production of French ammunition would last about 3 or 4 weeks in the war in Ukraine. That's the annual production. So, we're still very far behind. And the last thing which I think is interesting as well is something that they both mentioned, is a pivot of Macron. This is something we discuss about a lot more in the patron section. It's a pivot from Macron. Before the conflict, Macron was quite optimistic that nothing would happen. He famously went to Russia 2 or 3 days before the invasion, came back saying kind of peace in our time. Well, not peace in our time, that's unfair, but came back thinking, I think we've saved peace. And obviously two days after, the Russian tanks were rolling through the border and invading Ukraine. He also said a few months later that we shouldn't be humiliating Russia. There was this attempt, which I think was foolhardy, from Macron to kind of be the bridge between Russia and Europe in some ways, to kind of find a compromise, managed to find some kind of diplomatic solution. It never went anywhere, but it also lost him a lot of political capital, especially in Central and Eastern Europe. What we're seeing at the moment is is a pivot from that. We're moving away from this image, which was really damaging, especially as Macron was always making the case for European strategic autonomy. Well, if that threat to Europe's autonomy at the moment is Russia, there was an understanding in Central and Eastern Europe that he wasn't taking it seriously enough, and therefore European strategic autonomy was another kind of fanciful French project. What he said about troops on the ground, again, it's very complicated. He's kind of saying this is all about strategic ambiguity, so you have to be careful with words you're using here. But that said, it signals that France is much more willing to put its money where its mouth is on Ukraine defence. And I think, actually, we didn't talk about it, but there was a big controversy in Germany. Chancellor Olaf Scholz, seemingly in a gaffe, mentioned the fact that both the UK and France had troops in Ukraine helping the Ukrainians with long-range missiles. He was absolutely hosed for saying that, because that's obviously a huge breach of security. He was hosed by British authorities. He was hosed in Germany by even people in his own coalition saying, you cannot do that. This is completely irresponsible. But interestingly, it's moments like that which will kind of help Macron make that pivot by making this difference with Germany, by saying, you know, we are serious, we are not doves here. The one thing, though, is if you look at the numbers, there's the famous tracker from the Kiel Institute, which has become the de facto Bible on understanding who has sent military equipment. France is still far behind Germany, and it's been a issue of constant irritation in Paris over this tracker. And they were really hoping that the tracker would change its metrics a little bit. It's about pledged commitments rather than actual commitments. Paris says it has to keep stuff under the radar for security concerns. It also argues that France is actually sending equipment which is ready to use and not kind of stuff it had in their stocks, which weren't immediately actionable for Ukraine. So a lot going on. There's a lot of jockeying on the European stage of a war in Ukraine. So I thought it was really useful to get their perspectives on this, to do a kind of fast trek across Europe on the question of defense.
Yeah. And actually, I'll just perhaps just close very briefly by reminding that I think when we set off to begin this project, some of the civilizational dilemmas that we wanted to address, and specifically in relation to the United States and this sort of bilateral friendship, which, as Shashank said, is tainted with economic self-interest. He even used the word jealousies, which I thought was very interesting. But one of the issues we set out to address is, well, what is actually changing in the self-concept of Europe as a global player? I think this has really been a driving topoi in this podcast. And it's always good to sort of land back on the surface of wonky policy and how things are actually achieved by governments and ministries. Thank you to both Bruno and Shashank for being with us, and see you on the other side. See you on the next episode.
And as always, please rate and review on Common Decency on whatever platform you use. Feel free to send us your comments or questions either via Twitter at UndecencyPod or by email at UndecencyPod@gmail.com. Also, if you can, we would love to have you on in our Patreon. We have longer episodes. This week, for example, we focused on France and Macron's complicated and complex comments on sending troops in Ukraine. So if you want to hear more about that and about nuclear dissuasion, feel free to join us in our Patreon section for as little as €5 a month. Thanks again for Bruno and Shashank for coming on. Next time will be next week. We have gone to a every other week format, but at the moment we've got quite a lot of stuff in our pipeline, so you're getting more on Common Decency. There will be a big episode with big guests on the issue of artificial intelligence, so that should be very exciting. Thanks, Jorge, and see you all next week then.